keeping your eyes and ears open for those opportunities are so important.
Welcome to the Health Science Coach Podcast. My name is Drew Garner, and I'm a health science and physical education teacher. This is a podcast to help students, parents, and recent graduates learn about pathways into healthcare and sports medicine careers. These industry professionals lay out how their experiences have helped them get to where they are now. If you enjoy this content, please subscribe to the channel or download through your podcast player. Thanks again for spending some time with us today. Now let's dig in. So some of the trainings that you've talked about with therapy modalities, can you talk a little bit more about what those are as far as abbreviations or what the specific types of training modalities that you're trained in are geared towards?
Absolutely. So I think a big one, because it takes a lot of training, is play therapy. And so play therapy, people think of play therapy as you have a three-year-old in the room and you're going around playing with toys and that's, you're making it therapeutic somehow. So play therapy is not something that's evidence-based in the traditional sense, but it is something that's gaining evidence-based. So there's research happening on play therapy every day and different types of play therapy. And so play therapy does involve utilizing the language of play, because play therapy believes that play is its own language, play is its own developmental piece. And we all need to play and we all need to connect with the part of ourselves that is having fun and playing in order to heal. And so there are different ways to play that follow theories that lead to achievable outcomes. And so play therapy, it is something you can have a certification on and have letters behind your name. And so the letters is usually, an RPT, which I need to go fill out the paperwork for, but which is an RPT. And so you could be a registered play therapist. Another huge one that's out there right now, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier, is EMDR. So EMDR is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And so really the base of EMDR is using your brain and your brain natural processing unit to reprocess and desensitize yourself to traumatic events. And so it's really cool. I was on this research project at K-State. So I got training while I was at K-State in EMDR. And so I'm looking to be certified here soon. And we actually attached people, we put caps on them and little metal sensors that was tracking their brain waves while we did EMDR, which involves either moving your eyes or, having something that stimulates your body back and forth on each side of your brain to kind of stimulate this process of processing, desensitizing, and reprocessing a traumatic event that happened so that you can decrease the symptoms that come out of it. So let's say, for example, you were in a car accident and one of the symptoms that came out of it was a fear of cars. You could utilize this evidence-based practice, EMDR, to then reprocess how you remember that car accident and what, you learned out of it and what about your worldview changed that cars were now dangerous or whatever it is. Right. Then you could desensitize to it so that that same stimulus, that same trigger does not affect you as much anymore. And then you can reassign, a new meaning to that event so that it's no longer distressing. And there's really cool brain-based research coming out that is talking about the effectiveness of this. It's actually the leading therapy modality for soldiers and military coming out of active duty.
That would make a lot of sense. That's really interesting that reprocessing the event and re-identifying has so much powerful impact on a patient.
Absolutely. And the base behind a lot of these therapeutic modalities is that when we experience things that happen around us, we attach a meaning to it. We attach a feeling to it. We attach a thought to it. I'm not safe anymore. I am not good. I only break things. I'm only in trouble. And that those distressing thoughts or feelings about ourselves will cause symptoms, will cause us to be triggered in different ways that can impact, you know, the way we relate to others, that can impact our behaviors and different facets in our life. And that working through those processing, and that processing can look like talking about it. It can look like playing about it. It can look like, you know, different scientific measures like the EMDR, where you don't necessarily have to do a ton of talking, but your brain is reprocessing. That reprocessing and attaching new meaning to scary or painful things can guide healing.
Yeah.
And can redefine who we are or how, what we believe about the world.
So when you're dealing with patients or clients and their mental health, what does kind of the ideal client or person look like that you would see come in to talk with you? I mean, there's got to be some qualities that they have to have, like a self-realization of, hey, we need to have this somebody helping with us with our mental health, as well as that kind of vulnerability to actually talk about the things that are going on. So what does that ideal client kind of look like?
Absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head, like recognizing I need help. And the biggest piece that I look for in clients coming in is the readiness for change, because you can know that you need to change, but maybe not be ready for it. And you can come in somewhere and say, these are the things that are wrong. These are the things that I want to change. But if you're not in a place where you are ready, where you are, you know, able to become vulnerable, or where you're willing to take action or willing to begin processing and talking about it, then the best therapy techniques are not really going to go anywhere. So the only, I think, qualification or thing that I would indicate a successful client to me is readiness for change. That when you come to me, you are saying, I'm ready to go through this process, and I'm ready to heal.
Okay.
And that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, I mean, that just as simple as that, to be able to really just say I'm ready and I know that I need some help, or that we need help. As far as professional development, you kind of talked on it a little bit as far as different states and how many hours that you need. What are the industry trends that you're kind of seeing as far as mental health?
Yeah. So one of the biggest things that are, I think, trending, and there's becoming more and more professional development available on it, is suicidality and self-harming. There's not really any hard and fast thoughts on, you know, why this is trending, or any research that's been able to be done. I think, for me, I'm noticing, I think for one of the first times in our lifetimes, and so millennials, Gen Z, you know, the lifetime of those that are, you know, young, or, you know, young adults, or, you know, right, in their mid adulthood. We've all experienced a massive group trauma. Yes, I'm talking COVID. Yes, I'm talking, you know, more social media, more online bullying. We are experiencing these large scale trauma, and we're experiencing them together. We were all just stuck in our houses for over a year when COVID hit, and we weren't at school. We weren't, you know, connecting with others. We weren't learning how to function within our friend groups, to function within the group dynamics, and to really take care of ourselves in our regular worlds that are full of stress and that are not just us in our houses. And so one of the big topics that we have been reviewing as a field is suicidality, self-harming, and then also just the experience of grief. A lot of people think grief means I lost somebody has died, But grief is much bigger than that. Grief is just an experience of loss, period. And I think of the losses that we've experienced, like the loss of freedom when we were in COVID and we were, you know, restricted to being in our homes and couldn't go to school. The loss of that social experience of going to school, which is so important. I think especially when you are school age, that you are with others, you are within that more normative dynamic. Many of us lost people. People were lost through the COVID pandemic. Many of us lost, you know, just the experience of having a normal daily life. Being able to go to a restaurant was, you know, iffy there for several months, or just to be able to go to work and not be via Zoom, to go to meetings and see other people, or just to hang out with your friends at a mall, go to a movie. There was a lot lost through COVID, and that we continue to experience this loss. And so that's also been a really big topic within the field, is how to define grief, how to define loss. And then once we are able to more further, you know, expand the definition of it, now what can we do about it? Not just on an individual level, but mm-hmm. as a system.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, the loss and grief and dealing with that, the mental pressures of that, and especially for school age kids, something I talk about in health class is, you know, as you get older, the experiences that you've had, you were able to grow on top of those. And kids in high school have talked about, you know, family members that have passed or friends that have passed. And I wasn't 25 until I had to deal with that. So I had 25 years of experience until somebody that was close to me passed. And dealing with that at the younger ages is really traumatic and hard for them to kind of put those pieces together and know how to feel and respond to that.
Yeah, and I think in this, I mean, I think about this past school year, and I think specifically, you know, because I am serving in Wyandotte County and I am here, you know, just off of state and 78th, and I have clinicians that go into the schools and staff that go into the schools. Just thinking about that experience that we've had of loss just in this past year, I don't know that I've ever heard of or ever experienced a year where so many students experienced losing so many of their classmates or their peers or, you know, just same age others. And that's huge and that's painful. And whether they were your best friend or whether you just, you know, found out about it in the news, this is your home and your community, your school, and it's scary. Yeah. And so I really feel for young people today because they are experiencing, I think, a really, they're experiencing a lot of challenges that I don't necessarily remember having to face when I was younger. And so, yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about advice you would have for younger people in high school, talking about getting into a mental health career or a therapy type career. As far as a high school student getting into that type of career, what advice would you have for them, maybe as far as job shadowing or talking to therapists, that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. So at a high school level, I would say start identifying those others that are around you. Maybe they're a teacher, maybe they're, you know, somebody in a sport or a club that you know, somebody that your parents know, that may have any form of involvement in, you know, whatever career you're going towards, but in mental health, and start asking questions. Start asking, you know, what are the hardest parts of this job for you? What are the best parts of this job for you? You know, how hard was it to get into this field? How many jobs have you had in this field? What kinds of jobs do you like? And really just identifying the people who will be real with you, who can really tell you about their full experience, but also taking that with a grain of salt because everyone's different. Everyone's experiences will be different and they'll enjoy the same career in different ways. Also starting to maybe experiencing some volunteering. I'm trying to think of agencies. So in terms of job shadowing, it would be really difficult to shadow therapy because we are bound by laws of confidentiality. And so at high school level, it would be difficult for mental health therapy shadowing. But maybe volunteering with agencies that involve mental health or involve, you know, helping others in different ways. This could be, you know, something as volunteering at the animal shelter and working with helping people, you know, identify and attach with their animals, or, you know, volunteering with Boys and Girls Club, or volunteering with, you know, anywhere that involves working with others. Because when we get down to the base of it, that's what this is about. We want to work with and help others. And that at the high school level, and also starting to research about what kinds of this career are out there. Where would I have to go to school for this, and where could I start?
Yeah, I think that's good options. As far as a college undergraduate, you kind of talked about this a little bit earlier with that finding your mentor once you kind of find your path, or finding that mentor to help you find your path. I think that's really sound advice for that college advice. Do you have anything else to add with that as far as a, you know, like a sophomore, junior in college?
Yeah, I would just say don't take as many different classes and as many different types of specializations as you can. I think really liking a certain class is a good maybe way of even finding a mentor. People teach within this profession, within this career, because they have a passion for it and they want to teach and they want to mentor. So if you feel, you know, shy about it, and if you're like, well, what if they don't want to talk with me? What if they don't want to guide me? What if they don't want to sign up for this? They're up there at the podium and they made those PowerPoints and they sign up for this, and it's their job because they want to. Finding any sorts of internships that you can. Many mental health agencies do have bachelor's level internships that people can get experience in the field. Like social work will have internships. Case management will have internships. You know, different pieces like that. And find your mentors out in the community. It can even be something like you hear someone on a podcast like today. If anybody was interested in talking about this career, talking more what this is, I would be open to talking with anyone. So just identifying, you know, if there's someone out there and they're talking about it and they seem really interested about it, they do want to talk with you and they do want to help.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that fits in really well. Now, as far as someone that, you know, maybe 6 months away from graduating college, you know, it could be their undergraduate or their master's. They're getting ready to look for their first job in mental health. What advice would you have for them as far as, you know, searching out that job or like honing in on some skills?
Yes, choose your internships wisely. Many of our mental health professions will have required internships within a facet of mental health. Choose them wisely. Really think about, you know, what kind of work do I ultimately want to be doing? Not just what's available, what I've heard is easy, but, you know, this sounds really hard, but also it sounds like something that I want to start learning and start growing in. We have had a lot of interns actually that have interned here or at Wyandotte Center, our adult side, that have done the work, that have experienced it, that have been able to know what it's like to be at this specific agency, that have chosen to then be employed here. And we love employing our interns. Right. And it's also a great way of finding more mentors or more information about, you know, what you want to do. So while there are going to be hundreds of internship options, I think really going for the one that speaks to you, or really listening to your teacher that, hey, I think this might be a good experience for you. It sounds hard, or, you know, it's kind of far away, or, you know, you would have to do a lot of crisis work, or, you know, there's a lot of paperwork involved. Just following your gut and just jumping for whatever sounds interesting, honestly.
Right. Yeah, I like that. And then let's look at somebody that's been on the job for 6 months. You know, they've learned all the policies mm-hmm. and procedures. They've started working with their own patients. They've started that building their clientele load. What advice would you have for them to focus on or look at trying to keep a positive mindset, that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. So utilize your supervision. So when you first go into the field, usually at your job place, you will have a supervisor who may or may not have your same license. Like, I'm a marriage and family therapist, but I supervise a team that includes social workers, professional counselors. I've had a psychology licensure before. So you will have supervision at your workplace. I also encourage you to go find yourself an outside supervisor, somebody who shares your licensure, who knows your theories, who knows your ethical code, and it's almost like a mentor, right. Someone you can lean on, that you can share your struggles with, that you can share, you know, the best parts of the job with, that you can share your insecurities. I know I've had a supervisor, and I've talked with her about, what if I'm not good at this? What if this isn't for me? What if I only think I'm helping, but I'm not? And it was the most crucial part for me, and I think for many therapists that are in this field, that you find what's called a clinical supervisor. I'm someone who will guide you towards becoming, you know, your advanced licensure, what we call a clinical licensure, to find your supervisor and utilize them. In this field, this is something I learned all through grad school, and something that you learn really quick: you cannot practice in isolation. You can't help people and then not have help yourself. And so my biggest advice to those that are actively going into the field, and you're starting to, you know, kind of get your feet wet and spreading your wings, is to find your people that you feel you can be completely honest with, that you can share your fears about the profession, that you can share your insecurities, that you can share your joys. Identify those people and use them often, and, you know, as you need.
Right. As far as your career goals, now you've been in this industry for 10 years. Where do you kind of see yourself 10 years from now?
Absolutely. So I thought about this a lot as I've just moved into kind of management. So I've always had a dream of going back and getting a PhD and getting a doctoral degree so that I can actually do some research. So kind of my grand plan was go into the field. And I think that when you're in school, and I think this is important to remember too, when you are studying therapy in school, you're studying like in a perfect world. Should everybody act this way and look this way, then these right. things will work. But when you go out, depending on where you're at, like Wyandotte County is going to be a completely different experience than Johnson County or Jackson County, or Kansas is going to be a different experience than Florida. So I really want to go out and gather as much information and experience as I can out in the community, and then go back to school and be able to research and to be able to, you know, and I haven't figured this part yet out, whether it's, you know, what kind of trainings need to be out there to help heal or change communities or school systems or, you know, governmental systems. I've always had this dream that one day maybe I would make a whole new therapy modality, and I would have a theory that's named after me someday. Getting that PhD level and being able to research something to kind of make my mark and help move the profession forward. And that's always kind of been my goal. Is I don't want to feel stuck somewhere. I don't want to feel like I'm just, you know, another runner. I want to, everywhere I'm going, feel like I'm making the best impact that I can. And so that's kind of my goal.
I like that. I think that's pretty cool. So yeah, we'll have to talk again once you have that PhD and are working in doing your research. As far as book recommendations for high school or college students, do you have anything that may be interesting for them to read if they're thinking about a career in mental health?
Yes. So I have a couple of books that I think are really interesting that are kind of my go-tos. Well, one actually is our DSM. So I actually have one here because it's my best friend. It's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So this is actually the comprehensive list of all of the diagnoses that we are able to give. And so what I think is interesting about this, and I probably wouldn't recommend buying it because it's extremely expensive, but if you can find it at a library or like find it somewhere, or you have a mentor that has one, just going through and reading about what kind of experiences and diagnoses are out there, I think was really fascinating for me to be curious about the scientific part of this career, the part that's beyond sitting in a room and talking. Uh-huh. We're sitting in a room and listening. Another book that really fascinated me about the brain-body connection, the brain-body-heart connection that is within therapy. It's a really heavy, very sciencey read, but it's called The Body Keeps the Score. And it's just a lot of information about how traumas and how, you know, experiences impact you as an individual, impacts your body, and how we hold on to trauma. So that is a pretty big read. I would recommend anybody that's going into any helping profession that involves others or other systems to read a book that's called Trauma Stewardship. And it's by Laura Vander Lipsky. She has a really I don't even know if I did that last name correctly. So what that book is about the experience of being a helper.
Okay.
The experience of being somebody that works with people or works with systems or works with this world, how that might impact you and what you can do to protect yourself and protect that part of you that is a helper and that is a caretaker. That book is one that one of my mentors made me read. I did not choose to read it at first. She made me read it. Right. And it really changed how I function within the profession, because something that you learn really quick when you become a therapist or a helper in any sort of way is it will impact you. Mm-hmm. You will change. You will have to build different unique boundaries and walls and different protective ways to keep that pain from impacting you. And so what that book is all about is how you can recognize if trauma of others is impacting you and what you can do about it, how you can take care of yourself. So I recommend that book for anybody that works with others.
Yeah, I like that. As far as likes and dislikes, as part of your professional career, if you dislike blank, then being a mental health professional is not for you.
Yes, I would say first and foremost, if you dislike hearing others' problems, this career is not for you.
Right into that book recommendation about, you know, hearing their problems and how it affects you.
Yes. If you are not somebody who likes to talk with somebody or likes to listen or likes to, you know, deal in people, mm-hmm. If you get irritated by the grocery store clerk that says hello, then this is not the career for you, because it is an all people career.
Absolutely. So then if you do like blank, like you kind of mentioned, helping people and talking and listening, this might be the right career path for you. Do you have anything else you'd like to throw in there?
I would say if you just like the psychology piece, the psychology of change, the psychology of people, and you're someone who likes to, you know, research or put pieces together, fix, you know, the puzzle pieces, but specifically you have that curiosity in people, this would be a really great field to explore. Like I said, there are different levels and types of therapy, different things that you can do in this career. And we need people that are in it for the curiosity, for the research, for just figuring out what makes people tick and what we can do about it, for the problem solvers. We need those people to be in this field as well, to be, you know, well-rounded. We need our scientists. We need our experts in the field. So if you are someone whose, you know, long-term goal might be psychology research or relationship research, community research, this career may be one that helps enhance that for you.
Do you have a mantra or quote that you kind of live your life through and explain how it's relative to you personally?
Wow, that is a tough question. So I think there are a couple things, ways that I could go with this. One, I think as a therapist, one really important thing I do think I want to address that's probably the bigger mantra in this. It's not a quote, but it's just an idea of being a therapist is part of what you do and it's part of your interest, but it doesn't have to be all of you. And so I think people look at therapists sometimes and they're like, wow, they're a really calm person. They've got it all together. They're holding all the pieces. They know something that none of us know. And I bet they're doing great. Right. So one of the pieces that I think has been really important to me and to some of my friends that are in the fields is remembering that we are still us outside of the room, outside of, you know, when I'm managing or outside of when I'm training or doing podcasts and things like that, like today. I am still Diane and I still have my flaws and my faults. I still make mistakes and I don't always practice what I preach. You know, those types of things that being a therapist is just a piece of who you are and a part of you, but it doesn't have to be everything. You can still be yourself and have this other part where you have this passion and can work with others.
Yeah.
So if you just feel like you're like, I'm not Zen, I'm not mindful, I don't do everything right, I don't always make good choices, that's not what it means to be a therapist. The base qualification to be a therapist is to be a human, and to accept that you are a human.
Yeah. I mean, in theory, that's all a good, big, positive, you know, thought of how to just, you know, work with other people and how to treat them as other humans too. So that's pretty interesting. If someone's interested in getting hold of you, finding out more about mental health and maybe in Wyandotte County or just in general, do you have any social media channels or websites that they could check out?
I am not that technologically cool, so I personally do not, but I am open just to anybody who is interested in speaking further and speaking about this career, who might need, you know, a mentor, a starter mentor to kind of help, you know, with what path they might take, what classes would be good, what their passions may be. I am open just to, you know, an email or a phone call or, you know, just a one-on-one outreach. I am, like I said, there are people in, when you're in this role and if what you do is to spread the word about therapy and being a therapist and doing the training, you want people to come to you because you want, you know, you want people to come into this field, people who are passionate and well-meaning and who want to do the work.
Okay. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with us and really going in depth and talking to us about mental health and your career and education. We really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
If you've made it this far into the episode, I want to thank you again for watching. Please subscribe, share, and comment below with any questions or comments you may have. If you're interested in more information about other professions within healthcare careers, please visit healthsciencecoach.com and talk to your school counselor or academic advisor. As always, stay happy, healthy, and live life with passion.